From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. On the show today, we'll hear from some Jewish community members in New Orleans about a recent anti-war Passover demonstration. And one of our reporters steps into the newly reopened Dewdrop Inn, a music venue that played a big role in the civil rights movement. But first, Louisiana is facing a black infant and maternal mortality crisis. According to the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, black infants in Louisiana are more than three times as likely to die from premature birth as white infants, and black mothers more than twice as likely to die from pregnancy-related causes as their white counterparts. Legislation before the Louisiana legislature this current session seeks to address this crisis. Advocate groups and survivors have been sharing their concerns at the Capitol as lawmakers hear proposed bills. Frankie Robertson represents several maternal health groups. She's a consultant with the Amandla Group and joins us now. Hello, Frankie.
Hi, Karen. Thank you so much for having me today.
Frankie, could you first describe the crisis in Black maternal health? What do the numbers say? What do the statistics tell us?
So the data shows us that Louisiana has, as you mentioned, a Black maternal and infant health crisis. I mean, we have a maternal and infant health crisis throughout the state, no matter the race or ethnicity of the mom and baby. But there is a huge disparity as it relates to the outcomes, the pregnancy outcomes related to Black women and our infants. We know that Louisiana has one of the nation's highest preterm birth rates. That means babies who are born before 37 weeks of gestation. And we also have one of the nation's highest maternal death rate as well. And that's women who do not survive childbirth during childbirth or within that year after childbirth. So it tells us that Louisiana has a very serious problem that's rooted in a lot of things that's contributing to these really poor birth outcomes that are largely preventable for Black women and our infants.
Well, we know Black mothers and infants have historically faced challenges that have led to these negative outcomes. What are some of those challenges?
There's a host of challenges. If you look at some of the root systemic issues that create disparities in various aspects as it relates to our lived experience, at the root of this, we know that economics is fueling a lot of it. The disparities in being able to earn a fair living wage, the disparities in the subsequent effect in terms of housing, transportation, the disparities in access to quality, reliable, equitable healthcare, disparities in terms of the types of employment is available, disparity in terms of whether or not you will have leave or available to you after you have a baby, and if you're able to recover mentally and physically while having enough money to support your growing family, whether or not your voices will be heard by medical professionals before, during, and after pregnancy, whether or not you have access to a hospital or medical facility or maternity care services, whether or not you live in a desert. And then we also know that we've known this for decades, that your zip code dictates your longevity in life, not to mention your quality of life.
So what efforts are in place to address some of these that women are facing during childbirth and pregnancy?
There's quite a few efforts that are underway, whether it's at the department level, the health department internally, or the result of advocates and policymakers related to legislation and legislative instruments this session. A few I'll name relate to some of the best practices and evidence-based practices that we know contribute to better birth outcomes and address some of the deadly disparities that I mentioned. For one, research has told us time and time again that doula support services can help reduce poor birth outcomes, particularly C-sections and preterm birth, as well as a myriad of other indicators that impact pregnancy. There's legislation right now filed by State Senator Regina Barrow, Senate Bill 142, and State Representative Matt Willard, House Bill 702, that would require Medicaid to cover doula support services. So moms who are insured by Medicaid can have access to the same type of life-saving support of a doula as a part of their birth team as one who's privately insured.
And you mentioned Senator Barrow's legislation. I know she has another bill, Senate Bill 143, that requires screening for hypertension, high blood pressure. These are two bills that have already passed out of committee.
They have, and bipartisan support, might I add, as well. So the bills are right now, they're headed to their respective money committees, as we call them, Senate Finance and House Appropriations, while the state works out what it can do, or what it will do, rather, in terms of prioritizing the health and needs of moms or babies. Will they invest the money or will they not?
We're talking with Frankie Robertson, a consultant with the Amantla Group, which represents several maternal health groups, about legislation to address a crisis in Black infant and maternal health. Okay, Frankie, so there's some bipartisan support that you're seeing so far for some of the bills. What are some of the major bills that you're looking at right now that you're keeping your eye on? I know you have several of them. Could you pick a few of them and tell us about them and where they are in the legislative process?
Absolutely, Karen. The two I'd like to highlight are basically related to Medicaid coverage. So the first set is Senate Bill 142 and House Bill 702. These are two bills that would require Medicaid to cover doula support services, just as private insurance began covering those services earlier this year. This would save lives as well as saving our state millions of dollars annually. House Bill 489 is authored by Representative Jason Hughes, and this bill touches upon some very necessary urgent services that should be covered by Medicaid. One is remote patient monitoring. That is basically a godsend, especially in some of the rural communities where moms have lack of access to transportation to get to their medical provider, and often. This would allow medical providers to monitor particularly or especially high risk patients at home and then be able to immediately inform them when they need to come in for further or closer monitoring or for a medical intervention. It will also require Medicaid to pay for double electric breast pumps, meaning more quality breast pumps and sooner, so that moms don't have this gap and lose out on a great opportunity to develop a healthy breastfeeding experience.
What do you believe is the biggest obstacle to seeing improvement in these areas?
I see the obstacles a lot of times as political will. People often ask me, and they ask my colleagues and community partners, why is there such a disparity in the health of Black moms and our babies? And you tell them the answer, and they want to know an easier answer. That is a problem. We have report after report, study after study, research after research that says what the problems are. And we have to have people who have the political will to do what's right, to work in a bipartisan fashion, to advance money where it needs to be in the budget, to be able to make sure that these priorities can be met and that moms and babies can have the healthiest opportunities afforded to them as possible.
Frankie Robertson with the Amantla Group, representing maternal health groups. Frankie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Karen. It's been a pleasure.
From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. The legendary Dewdrop Inn has reopened its doors. The two-story music venue in Central City, New Orleans, drew huge crowds in the 1950s and 60s when it became known as a safe haven for Black performers during Jim Crow segregation. The likes of Ray Charles, Etta James, and Aretha Franklin performed and stayed there. But the Dewdrop closed down after Hurricane Katrina when it suffered major damage. Now that it's finally back open, reporter Matt Bloom took a visit to the venue.
One of the most famous stories about the Dewdrop Inn involves Little Richard. In 1955, while visiting New Orleans, the singer performed on the club's stage and improvised the opening line to one of early rock and roll's first hits. Richard later recorded and released Tutti Frutti, which made him a star. It's just one of countless songs born out of jam sessions at the venue, which also included a barbershop and hotel on site, and welcomed performers of all races and sexualities in a time where that wasn't the norm.
It was more than just a bar or a club. It was a meeting spot.
Kenneth Jackson is a part owner of the venue and the grandson of the original owner, Frank Pena.
You know, it was a place where people came to mingle and enjoy one another's company, see a good show, have a good meal, get a good haircut if you wanted to, get a good night's sleep if you got too drunk. Just an overall fun, atmospheric.
He says the open atmosphere made it feel safe, especially for Black and LGBTQ performers who were rejected from segregated hotels. Over time, it became the place for big acts to perform.
And they mixed in with a lot of locals, Deacon John, Irma Thomas, you had Alan Toussaint, and they would blend in, you know, whoever was on the show that night, whoever came in, if they felt like joining in, they'd invite them to come up on stage and just join in.
Through the 80s and 90s, the club saw business decline as other venues became more integrated. In 2005, Hurricane Katrina flooded the whole place and shut it down. But Jackson says his family always wanted to reopen it.
The city deserves a place of this magnitude and of this historical significance.
After Katrina, the family wasn't able to come up with the financing to restore the building on its own. So Jackson ended up selling a majority stake in the Dewdrop to a local developer. After several years of renovation, the building reopened as a hotel and music hall this past March. And bands are finally playing again on a restored stage.
One, two, one, two, three, four.
Musicians host a weekly jam session that's open to the public. On a recent night, a live band backed up the host, DC Paul. Members of the crowd write their names on pieces of paper and get to go on stage if their name gets drawn. Paul, who is known for hosting jams all around town, says it feels like they're continuing a legacy here.
I would say that history has been made in this space, and history is still being written today and tomorrow, and is being written in this space.
In the audience are some Dewdrop veterans, including performer Albert Doucette, who jumps on stage to sing.
I say, in the world there'd be no party without us. I said, won't there be no party without us?
Okay. Doucette performed at the Dewdrop back when it was in its heyday. He says he's thrilled it's been brought back to life.
Oh, I think it means a lot for the city. I just hope the city gets behind him. We need the people back to this area, support the area.
The new Dewdrop Inn will remain open 6 days a week. Owners are planning big events for Jazz Fest and other upcoming festivals with live music every single night. In New Orleans, I'm Matt Bloom.
From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. Passover wraps up today at sundown. The holiday celebrates Jewish liberation from slavery in Egypt. This year, many Jews have grappled with how to celebrate the holiday amid the ongoing war in Gaza. One Jewish community group in New Orleans held a, quote, liberation seder, or ceremonial dinner, on the streets of downtown. Drew Hawkins, reporter with the Gulf States Newsroom, documented the demonstration and sent this postcard.
May the seder begin!
Ashrei, Ashrei.
Cut the bombs and the killings.
I'm Miriam Eisenstadt. My role is to participate in the Seder with JVP. I'm Jewish. Both of my parents are rabbis. Passover is a time, it's a holiday to resist against the status quo. It is to resist against the status quo of oppression and to fight for liberation.
There's no liberation without Palestinian liberation.
In other years, we would drink 4 cups of wine on Passover.
So we've changed that in the understanding that as Jews in our Jewish tradition, we have a mandate to repair the world, tikkun olam. That's one of our central virtues. And this is in line with our Jewish values.
Our Seder plates are empty.
So for instance, we're not eating and drinking. That is to pay homage to the millions of Palestinians who are starving right now in Gaza.
Today we do not feast while the people of Gaza are facing famine.
And in that way, we're also commemorating the Palestinians who have died throughout this genocide.
No more, no more war, we call for a ceasefire.
That was sound from a demonstration held last week during Passover. The group behind the demonstration was the New Orleans chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, a grassroots organization that advocates for Palestinian freedom and describes itself as anti-Zionist. Joining us now are a few members of the organization. Rory Michelin is a New Orleans resident and membership manager, and Marlena Fireman is a student at the University of New Orleans. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rory, can you help us understand what the main message of this Seder is?
Sure. The main message of this Seder was that Zionism and Judaism are two very different things. It's not anti-Semitic to be critical of the Israeli government, which in the past 200 days has killed 34,000 Palestinians and wounded 78,000. Passover, a holiday celebrating Jews' own liberation, was the perfect opportunity for us to share this message.
What has this Passover been like for you?
Well, Passover has always been difficult for me. Having a Jewish mother and a Palestinian father, it's been hard to find a Jewish community that aligns with my values. The Seders I attended growing up focused on liberation of Israelites from Egypt. However, they always seem to omit any acknowledgement of the Palestinians who have currently been seeking their own liberation from Israel. This year was different. I found Jewish Voice for Peace, which understands my values as a Jew, are in line with mine for Palestinian freedom and safety. Being able to participate in Wednesday's Seder and celebrate Passover alongside other members of Jewish Voices for Peace has allowed me to reconnect with my Jewish heritage while feeling accepted as a Palestinian.
Have you seen other Jewish community organizations marking the holiday at this time?
I've seen a lot of my friends, including olives, as part of their Seder. The olive tree is an ancient symbol of peace, and it also symbolizes the destruction of Palestinian olive trees by Israeli settlers and the Israeli government.
We've seen a spike in protest activity in our area ever since October 7th, when Hamas attacked Israel and killed around 1,200 civilians. Israel's military assault on the Gaza Strip in the months since has killed at least 30,000 Palestinians. That's according to the territory's estimates. And over the past few weeks, we've seen a lot of headlines about anti-war protest activity spreading across college campuses. Marlena, have you seen this show up at UNO or other campuses in your area?
Yes, it's happening all over the country. There's going to be an event today on our campus at UNO, and I will be there and I will be speaking. We really welcome the courage and determination of students all over the country who are, in support of ending the U.S. aid to Israel and calling our universities to divest from supporting the Israeli military. You know, history has shown us over and over and over again that young people know what's up. It's young people who spoke out against the war in Vietnam, who pressured universities to divest from South African apartheid. It's really integral that we're following the lead of young people who are calling for an end to this.
We're speaking with Rory Michelin and Marlena Fireman, New Orleans residents and members of the city's chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, about this year's Passover holiday and growing anti-war demonstrations. Jewish Voices for Peace is a Jewish-led organization. What do you think it means that one of the most active organizations calling for a ceasefire is led by the Jewish community. How do you think that challenges what people might assume Jewish people are thinking about this crisis?
Well, Jewish values teach us peace. So many of our family members have lost loved ones to the Holocaust, and we're too familiar with genocide. As Jews, it's in our bones to make sure that history doesn't repeat itself, not just for Jews, but for anyone. So I hope that the work that Jewish Voice for Peace is doing clarifies to people that it is not anti-Semitic to be critical of and speak up against the Israeli government.
Marlena, have you seen university leaders here responding to protest activities on campus? And a note, we have reached out to LSU, UNO, and Tulane about their policies, but they declined our request.
Yeah, you know, these universities are claiming to be bastions of free speech, but, you know, a lot of the time are suppressing peaceful protest movements, which is really scary. And in some instances, the mainstream media are calling these demonstrations anti-Semitic. And it's not anti-Semitic to protest the actions of the Israeli government, which really is, you know, waging a genocidal war on Gaza. And these demonstrations all over the country include so many really proud Jewish students. And I am not going to be the only Jewish student there this afternoon. And these brave students are having Passover Seders and Shabbats in these encampments where they're, you know, really committed to Palestinian freedom. And something else really interesting is that, and you know, this is really deeply entwined with my own identity, which is that you know, my Jewish tradition compels me to join this movement. My Jewish tradition compels me to use the voice that I have. And, you know, I feel really welcome in this movement. It's interfaith, it's multiracial, and it's, you know, we're all in solidarity for in this movement for Palestinian freedom.
Israel's leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, has said he plans to continue his military campaign to end Hamas by invading Rafah. Do you both expect there to be more demonstrations this summer?
I say, as we've witnessed this genocide for the last 200 days, we have not tired. We've only grown louder, and we're calling for an end to the deadly occupation. So we will continue to protest until Palestinians are safe and free.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, just to add to that, that this movement deserves our dedication. It deserves our patience. So, yeah, there's no way we're going to stop. We have to just, you know, we have to keep working because this is, you know, this feels like the right thing to do.
And Rory, how do you balance protest rights with public safety?
Well, at JVP, we engage in peaceful, nonviolent tactics similar to the sit-ins of the civil rights movement. The Seder we witnessed on Wednesday was just a religious gathering where we were partaking in a shared meal, sitting and praying together. But across movements, whether it's protesting segregation, an end to the AIDS crisis, the Vietnam War, protests in America have been defined by everyday people of all backgrounds, races, and religions showing up, speaking out, and demonstrating in the face of risk. So we will continue to demonstrate until we are all safe and we're all free.
Rory Michelin and Marlena Fireman, New Orleans residents and members of the city's chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace. Thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you've been listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. Thanks to our guests, JVP members Rory Michelin and Marlena Fireman, reporter and producer Matt Bloom, and the Amandla Group's Frankie Robertson. Our managing producer is Alana Schreiber. Our contributing producers are Matt Bloom and Adam Voss. We receive production and technical support from Garrett Pittman and our assistant producer, Aubrey Purcell. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at noon and 7 p.m. on this station. It's available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from the Historic New Orleans Collection.